Let's go. Hello. Sasan, can you hear me in the back? Let's have a welcome. Howdy.
Howdy.
Okay. That's pretty sad, but let's see if we can keep going. Okay. So welcome. I'm Jeffrey Snover, distinguished engineer and lead architect for Windows Server. And again, very proud to talk to you today about standard support and interoperability in Windows Server 2012. Windows Server 2012 is an amazing release, and there's a ton of great standard support for it, and we wanted to come to this audience and articulate that case. So in particular, we have standards throughout the OS, but there are three areas that kind of build upon one another, and we thought that together, networking, management, and storage formed a really good story, so we'd communicate that to you. Okay. So first, a little context, right? In the past, and this motivates how we think about things and why we're doing some of the things that we're doing, right? So in the past, Windows Server really saw itself, we saw ourselves as being an operating system for a particular box, right? And we did a great job at that, right? Today, of 100 servers sold, 75 of them will have Windows Server on them. So extremely successful as a operating system for a server. But really, going forward with Windows Server, that should be Windows Server 2012, these are old slides. Windows Server 2012, we want to be a great operating system for lots of servers, the devices that connect those, whether they're physical, virtual, on-premises, or off-premises. So this is a cloud OS. And being a cloud OS, we need to do things differently. You know, everything is the same, and yet everything is different as well. And in particular, a cloud OS needs to support standards, okay? So the traditional job of the operating system has been to abstract the underlying hardware, right? Now, cloud OS, we need to extend this to abstract the underlying data center itself. So that's storage, servers, networking, power distribution units, et cetera. And standards, and we call this, right? So, you know, years ago, the wild, wild west of computing was a random world. And Microsoft, along with the industry partners, got together and established a set of standards that we now call the HAL, the hardware abstraction layer. And this is, you know, the unsung hero of the computing industry, because it is the HAL that allows you, you know, infinite choice and surety that things are going to just work, right? None of us think about buying a new PC and wondering whether Windows is going to run on it. Of course it's going to run on it. And in fact, the new versions of Windows will run on it, and the old versions of Windows will run on it, and the new version of Windows will run on old PCs. And why does that magic all work? We don't really think about it very much. And the reason it all works is because of standards. It works because of the HAL standards that we established for a machine a very long time ago. So now as we make this transition to a cloud OS, we have to do it again. But now instead of having the standards necessary within a box, we need to have the standards outside for the entire data center. And so that's what we're calling the data center abstraction layer, or the DAL. So here's a stack that we're going to walk through today. At the bottom here are some networking standards that we'll talk about, DCB, or data center bridging, the ability to talk to fiber channel networks for storage, RDMA, remote direct memory access, for being able to offload information, offload processing to hardware, IP, HTTP. And then the nice thing about that is on top of that is a set of management standards. And the management standards build upon the networking standards. Why does our management work across firewalls? Why does it work across proxies? And the answer is because we build upon HTTP. Okay? So our management standards are built upon our networking standards. And upon that, we layer standard data models, SIM, standard schemas, and like SMIS and SMASH. And then on top of that is storage. And storage takes advantage of both the networking standards, DCB, as well as the management standards, okay? And then off to the side there is PowerShell. PowerShell is a scripting language. It's an automation engine. It's essentially the glue and the user experience that ties all these things together for the IT pro. So that's the stack we'll be walking through. Now, why do you care about this, right? Why are we talking about standards? Like, just do it and shut up, right? No. Standards are very important. What they allow you to do is to give essentially that plug-and-play experience, right? How many of you have ever tried to install a CD-ROM before plug-and-play? Anyone? Okay, right. So I don't know about you, it took me over a day. It took me about a day and a half. There were IRQs, and there were jumpers, and there were IO addresses, and oh my God, and I was on the verge of tears. And people I've talked to have said, yeah, I cried. You know, it just broke down. It was just so hard. And now what happens? And the answer is, you get a CD-ROM. Nobody uses CD-ROMs anymore. But if you had one, you know, you just plug it in, and plug and play says, oh, sniff, 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 I discovered that device. I invent, inventory it, like what is it, find out what it is, find the appropriate software, configure the device, bring in the appropriate software, and make it available for use by the rest of the system. Plug and play, right? So that's all because of standards. And what we need the data center equivalent of that. Oh, I plug in a new server. Sniff, sniff, sniff. Find a server. What is it? Find out inventory. Find the appropriate software. Configure the machine. Make it available to the cloud. Okay? So that's why standards matter. Standards matter because they give you choice and they give you simplicity, things that will just work. Okay, so the other benefit is that implementing standards means that in addition to them just work, they minimize the software, right? So like SMIS, one of my favorite things about SMIS is there's a storage array out there, and if it implements SMIS, Windows will manage it without you having to install any extra software on Windows. And here I'm being a little bit selfish. Turns out that when other people install software, drivers in particular on Windows, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. If they don't work, we still get blamed. So not having other people's driver software on our machine is generally a pretty good thing. You know, we invest pretty heavily in our quality and our testing, and if you use our software, we're pretty confident you're going to get a great experience. It also minimizes the steps, right? So, hey, I installed this thing. How do I get it to run? And the answer is, when it's standards, the answer is just go manage it. Whereas, as opposed to, well, you plug it in, and then you got to go off, and you got to find the right software, and you got to install the right software, and then you got to see if it's updated, and you got to configure it, and blah, blah, blah. If it's standards, Windows is going to have the software, and we're just going to work. And it minimizes the systems integration. How do I bring all these pieces together? Does version 3 of that work with version 2 of that and blah, blah, blah? And often that's a pain that goes away. And ultimately, it minimizes your risk, right? You never have to go to your boss and say, hey, you know that big check you wrote? Didn't work out so well. It's just going to work. Okay, so basically standards-based management helps you make the data center far simpler. And by the way, we talk about this in the context of the Cloud OS, and indeed that's like our primary motivating force, but the reality is this. Reality is, if you're not going to go to the cloud, everything that we're doing here benefits you greatly as well. Okay, so it's a good deal. Okay, so with that, we're going to tell the story in a few chapters, and the first chapter is going to be brought to you by Sharad, who's going to talk to you about standards and interoperability and networking. Thanks, Sharad.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Hi, can you hear me? Thank you, Jeffrey. So my name is Sharad Kailasam. I'm a program manager in Windows Networking, and I'm going to be talking to you about standards and interoperability in networking. So the slide that you saw before with Jeffrey presented, I'm going to be talking about the bottom half of that, and specifically around some features that we've implemented in Windows Server 2012, which are based off of standards, namely remote direct memory access, like RDMA, and data center bridging, as well as the IPsec, IPv4, and IPv6 standards, as well as things like Hyper-V network virtualization, which we're in the process of forming a standard around. So we'll talk about a variety of new features we've implemented and how we've done it in a standards-based approach. Before we get started, let's set some context, right? So networking is this area where we have to rely on standards. We have devices which are, we have a variety of devices, and each of them need to talk to each other. And the only way we can make this possible is through the implementation of standards-based protocols. And it's fair to say that even the internet as we know it wouldn't exist without the implementation of these standards. So standards are essential for interoperability, and that's one of the underpinnings of the guiding principles that we use in Windows networking when we're building new features. The other aspect is that we live in a multi-vendor marketplace. And as Jeffrey mentioned, we like the customer, to have a choice when you're looking to buy networking gear. And we as Windows would need to interoperate with whatever networking gear you decide to buy for your on-premise or cloud data centers. So there are also a number of standards bodies that we work with in defining and implementing these standards. So let's go through some of these standards bodies. Starting at the bottom left there, you have the IEEE, which is the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, which they typically define standards at the L2 layer, the link layer, and that defines standards around transmission of hop-to-hop electrical signals between devices, if you will. We also have ECMA, which is the European Computer Manufacturers Association, which is instrumental around defining standards for power friendliness, which is a very hot topic in the market today because everything is about cutting down battery usage and expanding battery life, if you will. We have the IETF, which is the Internet Engineering Task Force, which defines a number of networking standards, including things like IPv4, IPv6, TCP, UDP, DNS, DHCP, you name it. There are standards for all of those things, and IETF is the body that is used to define those standards. And that's typically at the layer 3 or layer 4. And then moving up the stack, we have bodies like W3C, which defines standards in the web space around things like SOAP, for example. And finally, we have DMTF, which is the Distributed Management Task Force, which defines standards around things like virtual machines, the formats for those virtual machines, management interfaces around them, et cetera. All right, so before we get into the actual features that we implemented in networking for Server 2012, I'd like to give you an idea of how we think about standards for networking. There are lots and lots of standards out there, but when we're looking to implement a standard in networking, there are some guiding principles that we use to onboard that standard into Windows. So the first one there is this notion of end-to-end. So we like to think of things end-to-end, meaning that an example would be IPsec. IP security, which is a standard, and it allows for authentication and encryption between two hosts. So all the way from one host to the other host, regardless of what's happening in the middle. So it's not a hop-to-hop kind of a model, it's more of an end-to-end model. We also consider things like deperimeterization. So let me give you a little background on deperimeterization. So in the past, in the good old days, if you will, typically enterprises had networks which had a hard edge, right? They had firewall, everything inside the firewall was trusted, and everything outside was not. Clearly, we're no longer living in that kind of a world. We have data which lives in on-premise data centers, in the cloud. We have remote users accessing this data on-premise as well as in the cloud. And so the things have become very different, and this notion of the hard edge has gone away. So how do we then implement functionality and features that keeps this deperimeterization theme in mind? And that's something we consider as well. The next thing is policy-based connectivity. So we look to be able to manage your network on an ongoing basis through a policy-based mechanism. An example of this would be the Hyper-V network virtualization, which allows you to configure and manage virtual networks over your physical network. So we'll talk about that as well in a little bit. And the next thing is vendor flexibility, the main idea being choice, and just reiterating what Jeffrey talked about before, it is a multi-vendor marketplace, and we like to afford you the choice in purchasing decisions when you're looking to buy networking gear. And finally, we look at power friendliness. So we've got new silicon architectures like ARM out there, and we're looking at ways to be much more battery efficient from the networking stack when we look at standards. So you probably have heard of our AOAC, the always on, always connected functionality, which we put into Windows 8. It's not a standard yet, but something that we would be working on. We've also got things like hardware offloads, where we're implementing standards like IPsec task offload, which takes advantage of that. So in general, those are the various areas we look at when we're thinking of implementing a standard Windows. And at the end of the day, it's all about interoperability. So that's the underpinnings of our view of the world, if you will. All right, so what you see in front of you is a view of a hybrid cloud network with various pieces of various devices talking to each other. So let's start on the left and kind of work our way from a remote client out on the internet talking to various resources within the data center, and I'll touch upon various standards which are used for communication all along the way. So you've got a client sitting on the internet which is connecting up to their enterprise network via either the public cloud or the private cloud. And in Windows, we have a piece of functionality of, it's actually a server role, called the Unified Remote Access Role. And as part of that, we have Direct Access, which under the covers uses a combination of IPv4, IPv6, and IPv6 transition technologies, which are all based off of standards, to actually establish the connectivity channel between that remote client and the server on the edge of the cloud network. Now, moving into the actual cloud itself, you see a rack of servers there, and on that network, you can actually have Hyper-V network virtualization running. So network virtualization is basically a mechanism for you to virtualize your network. So an analogy to draw would be virtual machines virtualize the hardware on which they're running. Network virtualization virtualizes the actual network on which it's running. So in the diagram there, you've got a blue network and a red network. So they could be a representative of two different departments in your organization, for example, like your human resources department and maybe engineering department, and those two networks can be completely isolated from each other. Now, one interesting thing about network virtualization is that this is a standard in progress, if you will. It's not yet a standard, but it's something that we as Microsoft are working with partners in the industry and in the IETF to make it a standard. So the first step in the standardization process is actually to put together what's known as an RFC, a request for comments, through the IETF, and then it goes through a variety of iterations to then finally become a standard. So the RFC has been written and drafted, and we're working through the IETF to actually make this a standard. So it's something which is actually being formed as we speak. We've got NIC teaming. NIC teaming is this new feature we've introduced in Server 2012, which allows you to take multiple NICs and aggregate them into one super NIC, if you will, and I'll talk about that in a little bit as well, in more detail. But the interesting thing to note is that there is a standard, the link aggregation control protocol, that is implemented as part of NIC teaming. We've got data center bridging, which is an IEEE standard for converged storage and networking traffic, and RDMA, which is remote direct memory access, which allows for SAN level performance with virtually no cost, which is also an IEEE standard, and I'll talk about that more in detail as well. So let's start with IPv4 and IPv6. So as probably a lot of you know, last year, the IANA, Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, stopped handing out IPv4 addresses, right? So gone are the days when IPv4 was the emerging technology. We've run out of IPv4 addresses, and it's time to move to IPv6. And Windows fully supports IPv6. In fact, support for IPv6 was introduced in XPSP3 and turned on by default in Vista. And since then, it's been on by default. So Windows 7 and Windows 8 fully support IPv6. We actually have a engineering process within Windows that ensures that any feature that we do has to be IPv6 compliant. So any new feature we build into Windows in networking has to be v6 compliant, and that's one of the things we call the common engineering criteria. And so we have some strict processes in place to ensure that this happens. We take this very seriously. We also work with third parties, certification bodies, to ensure Windows is IPv6 compliant. So we have an internal process as well as an external process. So being IPv6 ready is something very critical to us. All right, so let's talk about NIC teaming. So just a quick overview of NIC teaming. In the diagram here, you see three NICs. And the idea is you can take those three NICs and combine them into one NIC. And what you get out of that is a number of different capabilities. One would be failure detection. So if one NIC goes down, the other NICs can take over and take over the traffic, which is was supposed to go to the failed NIC. You also have bandwidth aggregation, as well as frame distribution. So you get better throughput across your server. And we have the LACP, which is a link aggregation control protocol, which can intelligently distribute the traffic between the NICs in a team. And there are two different modes in which NIC teaming can run. The first mode is called the switch independent mode. So in this case, you've got the NIC team on your host actually connected out to three different switches in this case. And the idea being is that if one switch goes down, the failover will automatically happen to the other two switches. And you've got switch dependent mode. In this case, the NIC team is bound to a single switch, and you can have LACP, which is a link aggregation control protocol, running on the host, which allows for the switch to be able to distribute traffic between these NICs more effectively. This is an IEEE standard, LACP. So that's an example of something we've done in Windows Server 2012 using an IEEE standard. Data center bridging. So data center bridging comes into play when you've got storage and Ethernet traffic in your data center, right? So typically storage traffic is very bandwidth intensive, and so you want to be able to define some cost metrics to be able to have good distribution of traffic so that your storage traffic is not just like hogging the bandwidth. So that's where DCB comes into play. We have QoS improvements we've made to the networking stack in Windows, but that doesn't quite take care of the converged scenario, because the convergence is only happening on the mini port itself. And so you can enable DCB, and that allows you to define various traffic classes, if you will. And with those traffic classes, you can then define how much bandwidth each one of those classes is going to get. So that's another example of an IEEE standard that we've implemented in Server 2012, and looks like another instance of an old slide, but hey, we'll let that slide. And finally, we've got remote DMA. So remote DMA essentially allows you to transfer memory remotely from one machine to another without the CPU ever having to get involved. And this is implemented by our SMB stack in Windows Server 2012. And basically what that means is that you're cutting down on your CPU utilization while getting like super throughput, right? And in our initial testing, we found that the CPU utilization drops by about 2/3 with the when you use remote DMA. And in basically, the NICs can discover the remote machine's capabilities. And if the remote machine does support RDMA, then it'll use that as a preferred mechanism, and you get this fantastic performance. So CPU utilization drops by about 2/3. The access latencies is almost like you have a local disk. Even though you're accessing a file over the network, it feels like that file was local. And yeah, as part of the build keynote last year, we actually showed that you can get about 2 gig per second with less than 1% CPU, which is amazing. So I'm going to wrap up my section and basically state that networking is all about standards, right? Even the internet that we know and love is built upon standards, and that's our bread and butter. We talked about the guiding principles like end-to-end, deparameterization, vendor flexibility, et cetera, which are our guiding principles for networking. And finally, we talked about a number of features that we've built into Server 2012, that like LACP for NIC teaming, like data center bridging for converged storage and Ethernet traffic, as well as RDMA for low latency and high bandwidth storage. And so in terms of a call to action, for you when you leave TechEd and go back to your work, first thing would be to deploy IPv6. Most enterprise networks still are on IPv4, and the number of challenges with moving to IPv6, but the good news is from Windows we're ready, and it's something which is going to happen sooner or later given the IPv4 address exhaustion. So it's something for you to think about and start migration from v4 to v6 for your networks. Second thing would be deploy direct access. Direct access is our next generation remote access offering. And it uses a number of standards like IPsec, IPv6 under the covers. And we've made a number of improvements to it to make it really simple to deploy. So deploy direct access. Use NIC teaming in your data centers. Most servers already have NIC teaming enabled in some form. But if you don't, and you're the minority 25%, then look at NIC teaming as a new technology for you to deploy in your data centers. And finally, get SAN-like performance with low cost using remote DMA. And with that, I'm going to hand it off to Wojtek, who's going to talk to you about standards and interoperability in management. Thank you.
Is that someone open?
Oh, great.
Hi. I'm Wojtek Kozaczynski. I'm an architect in Windows Server Management Group. And in about 20 or something minutes, I'll try to explain to you what we have done in this, in this middle layer of standards, which is what have we done in the management and how we implemented a number of interesting things. And this is kind of stating the obvious that there is no management interoperability if there is no standard interface and protocol. So if you were to manage a disk or you were to manage a network switch, you would like to manage them the same way. If you for every device, you will have to design an intermediary by which you will talk to it, and there will be a different protocol. You eventually doomed. And you're doomed because it will complicate your deployment. You will have to maintain all those different, intermediate layers and consume additional resources, notwithstanding the fact that it may actually also open a security holes, right? So the first question is, if we need a standard interfaces to manage stuff and we need a standard protocol, what standard to choose? And you may remember that old joke, which is, what's good about standards? There are so many to choose from. We didn't have that problem because about a decade ago, we were one of the founding members of DMTF, which is Distributed Management Task Force. And at the end of the day, you need a standard. And usually there is something not quite okay with it. So you fix it, right, if it doesn't fit your needs. How many of you, show of hands, are familiar with the DMTF and all this other stuff? Okay, so some of you, excellent. But if you look at the DMTF standards, you can kind of think of it as three pieces. One is that there is SIM, which stands for Common Information Model, which is a very precise description how to describe an interface. So it's interface semantics. There are languages in which you can describe the interfaces. There's one is called MOV, the other one is called SIMXML. And that defines how you, if you were to describe how, what the interface will stick out of a disk or will stick out. Jeffrey in his talk yesterday was talking quite a bit about Arista switch and we're working with them. What interface will stick out of the Arista switch so we can talk to it and configure it? That's, the SIM defines how you describe that interface. WSMN protocol is the protocol which is, as you could see on the slide, previous slide, it's built of all the networking protocols that implements a set of operations, management operations. I'll talk about it briefly. And then the last one is that the same organization said, hey, if you're going to describe, let me start over. There's no reason to describe disk in 15 ways, so describe a process in 55 ways. There is this very extensible, large hierarchy of predefined standard objects, management objects, and it's called SIM schema. And as of my last check, it was about 1,500 different classes. It's a single hierarchy that describe everything. You want to find something, how to describe disk, you find. If you want to find how to describe a piece of software, you find it. Network, find it. A virtual machine, you'll find it, right? So if somebody is defining an interface for something new, it's usually a derivation of one of those classes that already exist. So that's the DMTF stack. And then we also started investing in something that has not been a standard about 2 years ago, but now actually has been submitted to standards group, which is OData. Show of hands, how many of you know what OData is? Not too many, okay. So OData is a standard for defining RESTful protocols. It's been started inside Microsoft with quite a bit of support from industry, IBM and other players, and has been submitted to standardization as of a month ago or something. So those are the standards we chose. And when we started looking at what we at that time called Windows Server 8. That's why you see those Windows Server 8. Now it's 2012. Then we set quite ambitious objectives for ourselves. One is that we would like a single management infrastructure, all those layers that span Windows and non-Windows. And you may scratch your head and say, why the hell is Microsoft thinking about infrastructure and non-Windows? Very simple reason. We will manage clouds, and in the clouds there are Windows and non-Windows devices and things, you know, switches and disk and other things. And we don't want to actually manage them differently. And our contract with the industry is that if you will be managed through standard way, we will be managed through standard way. So we said, okay, we'll figure out how to make an infrastructure that spans Windows and non-Windows. If we do this, we would like to have a single programming environment for instrumenting devices that run in Windows, on Windows, and devices that run on Linux or Unix, right? Then we said, okay, now let's go and say how people will be managing. And we said, PowerShell is the king. And I say that because Jeffrey's in my group. No, just kidding. So we said, hey, if you want to manage anything, manage that through PowerShell, period, if you're managing from Windows. But then the question is, what the hell are you supposed to do if you're not managing from Windows, you know, if you're managing from something else? And we said, okay. So for those cases that you're not managing from Windows, we said, we will expose OData, which is REST protocols, to manage our environment. So we will, if you're managing Windows, and if there is PowerShell underneath, I'll show you in a second, then we can always expose OData interface and you can manage us. So another way of looking at this, if you look at those objectives, you can think of two groups, two communities that we had to address, right? On the right-hand side is the community that actually builds the management interfaces. So those, I don't know how many of you are on that side, but if you instrument in your software, drivers, services, devices, then right-hand side is the community that actually writes that thing, what I usually refer to as the management surface, right? That's what I'm talking to. And for that community, we would like to make it dirt simple to instrument your stuff. Or maybe dirt simple is a little bit overstating, but remove the friction. Make it relatively simple so you don't stumble upon things that you shouldn't stumble upon. And then on the left-hand side, you have the community of users, which is the IT pros. And for those guys, we said, hey, you manage everything from PowerShell. If you from PowerShell, you can manage Windows, non-Windows. And if you're not in Windows, then you will have OData. So let me now go quickly through what we have done. So in terms of one management infrastructure, and the picture at the bottom shows a few pieces. So kind of from the middle, we created a completely new API for writing what is called providers. So if you're familiar with WMI, you define a class, which is the interface through which you manage, and then you have to write a provider that implements the behavior of this class, which is the guts, right? That's the thing that actually makes the management stuff. And we said one of the biggest complaints about the interfaces of WMI in the previous version was it was difficult to write those providers. We said, the hell with it. We created completely new interfaces that are much simpler. Then we said, okay, so to address this management infrastructure that is in Windows and non-Windows, we created OMI. And Jeffrey announced that OMI yesterday, the first time, stands for Open Management Interface. I'm sorry, Infrastructure. Infrastructure. So think of it this way. In Windows, we have WMI, Windows Management Infrastructure. That's this. Fundamentally, is the server that runs all those, you know, providers and connects to the guts of Windows and then talks WSMN to you. On non-Windows, it's OMI, and I'll talk a little bit about it, right? And then we fully implemented the WSMN. If you work with WSMN in the previous versions of Windows Server, you knew that it was not complete. There were some things that were missing. Right now, WSMN is complete. It's a full implementation. And actually, OMI supports WSMN on non-Windows, and then we built from scratch a new client stack, and I'll talk about this client stack, but it has nicely layered, it has an unmanaged layer, it has a managed layer, and then a PowerShell on top. It's a single stack, and if you look at it, if you're ever interested, if you have nothing better to do at night, I can point you at that .h, and you'll see that the interfaces on the client and the interfaces of the providers on the right-hand side derive from exactly the same header files. They're very consistent. So what's OMI? OMI is like WMI, but written from scratch. It's portable. It's written by probably one of the best, if not the best, guys in that space, Mike Brazier. It's very it's elegantly written in C, so it's very portable. It's very small, infinitely scalable. It's high performance, and I'm sort of building expectations. I'll tell you what I mean by this. It includes WSMN stack protocol. So in other words, if you deploy it on, let's say, Linux box, you can talk to it through over WSMN. It actually, we can interact with it through PowerShell, and I'll show you a small demo out of the box. So PowerShell talks to it out of the box and uses exactly the same new API as WMI. So you can write, so fundamentally you can design and write a provider right now and either implement it into OMI or WMI, and the interface will be the same. So I keep on saying portable, small footprint, and scalable, and all this other stuff, and you say, okay, so what does that really mean? So if you looked into what is available right now in non-Windows as another, what we call WebM server, WMI is an instance of a WebM server, sometimes also called SimOM, which means Sim Object Manager. So the real competition, which is in the open source domain, is Open Pegasus, and this table kind of shows head to head comparison between what Open Pegasus can do, which you can take it right now, and what OMI does. And I think that the right column is an indication of how superior that thing is, right? The OMI. One of the major reasons is that actually the guy who wrote OMI also wrote Open Pegasus, so he knew. So he knew what not to do. He came to us and said, I think I know better how to do that, right? And we said, sure, Mike, go ahead. Now, you may have like a question, like, why the hell would Microsoft donate that thing to the open community, which Jeffrey announced yesterday the first time. And it's simple. We don't want to go through the pain of managing things different way. We want to, it's a viral approach. We'll just give you that thing. We'll give you the OMI, build on it. We'll give you the tools, build on it. Because at the end of the day, it's about what we can bring to the cloud to manage. It's not about being different. I mean, we stopped being different. I mean, it just only got us into trouble. Let me talk a little bit about what we did in WinRM and WMI, which is now we're back into Windows. So OMI, you can download it. If you have nothing to do tonight, you can download. Do we have a URL somewhere? I think. You can download OMI today and try to run it. Actually, it runs also on Windows if you build it. Back to Windows. WMI is an old lady. I mean, in the internet world, ERS is she's ancient. But we have done quite a bit, which is, first of all, let's start from WSMN. We made WSMN a default protocol. If you worked with WMI in the previous version of Windows Server, the default protocol was DCAM. We kept DCAM. We kept DCAM not because DCAM is faster. We kept because head-to-head comparison because between WSMN and DCAM is that they're about the same right now. We optimized WSMN. So there is no much difference. We kept it for backward compatibility. Remotely, WSMN is the default. Locally, we'll kick into to DCAM, but you can change it to WSMN. So you can You can now manage without DECOM from remotely and locally, period. We greatly simplified development of WMI providers. Is there anybody in the audience who ever wrote a WMI provider? Sympathize with you. Lucky everybody else. It was a pain. Right now, it's just like this. You sit down with a tool, you define your class. By the way, I'll be in the booth tomorrow, Windows Server partial booth. If you want any details, please come. I'll show you that stuff. We don't have time right now. You just write your class, generate the code, compile the code, deploy the provider, and it works. It doesn't do anything because you didn't put the logic into it, but it will work. It will tell you that it does nothing, right? Just to get to that point in WMI was a pain, right? In other words, we removed all the friction, right? And now all you need to do is just put your logic, which you should know what you do, right? And if you can kind of look at the picture, you now write the providers and we plug them into WMI, and WMI believes that this is like any other provider, which we also call the old ones classic providers. Life is good. PowerShell client. So in the client area, we nicely layer the client, which we have the native API. If you want to write in C, your client in C, you can do that. If you would rather write your client in .NET, you can write your client in .NET. It's actually nicely layered upon the native. So you see the same set of abstractions, exactly the same. And then on top of that, there's PowerShell, which is actually written on top of the .NET layer. In the PowerShell, we have kind of two different ways to talk to SIMs and WMI, OMI. One is a set of what we call the SIM commandlets. The SIM commandlets is a set of commands. If you're familiar with SIM, you know that there is a set of generic operations, get instance, delete instance, modify instance, get class, you know, walk association, that sort of stuff. Those commandlets map one-to-one to those things. So if you're familiar with the MTF, you look at this, say, oh, of course, I can get all instances of, you know, I don't know, process or SMB share, whatever, right? The other one, this is the SIM-based commandlets, is a different species altogether. It's a commandlet generated by PowerShell on the fly. And it's generated from an XML file. So you can write this XML file, and you can deposit that on the server. And the PowerShell connects itself to the server, gets that file, and on the fly generates a proxy by which it can talk now to WMI. So in other words, you can kind of sort of deploy a module without really deploying the module, because PowerShell gets that stuff from the server. If you're ever interested what actually is this script looks like, go to PowerShell on Windows Server 2012 or even Windows 8. Get a command to a variable like get SMB share. Just get it to a variable and look at the property, which is called what is it called, Jeffrey? No documentation. I forgot. Definition. Oh. Look at the property definition, and you will see that script inside. So in other words, if you want to, as an IT pro, if you don't like our commandlets that talk to WMI, you can build your own. You can write that XML file that defines how to map and call it, and you can build your own commandlets. Okay. Let's now do quickly on data. OData is a, as I said, RESTful protocol, but it has an interesting property. The OData is built upon an explicit data model. So if you're defining an OData endpoint, you're defining, they're called entities, but they are really like classes. So you define classes in that OData endpoint, right? And you define their properties, and you define associations between them, and then OData protocol gives you a way of navigating through this object model, right? What we have done, we added a dispatching layer, which is declarative layer by which we can map or put OData interface on top of PowerShell modules. And you can scratch your head and say, hold on a second, PowerShell modules don't have an explicit data model, right? But they do have an implicit data model. What I mean by this, if you go and say get disk, you can infer the definition of a disk, right? You look at the properties of return and say, oh, PowerShell knows about disks and knows about, you know, these following properties of the disks. So you may say, hey, there is actually a notion of a disk. So what do? We have that tool that gravels through modules, infers the data model and says, okay, this set of commands in this module actually implies that model. We give it to the OData and we write, and so that's, we give it to OData as one of those declarative specifications, and another one that we tell how to call into PowerShell, and therefore we can do whatever. We can expose fundamentally OData interface upon any PowerShell module. This is phenomenally powerful and infinitely mealable. And by that definition, we can, you know, go through PowerShell to WMI or anything else. So let me, since I'm really short on time, let me show you a few quick demos, which I actually screen captured, not to fiddle here with the keyboards and networks that may not work. So I have three very quick, it's unmanly, but, you know, I value my blood pressure. It's like trying to figure out whether I will get, you know, connected to the server that's in Redmond. It's like raises my blood pressure too high. So I have three quick demos. One is that shows how PowerShell talks to non-Windows things, which are BMCs, which is motherboards, right? Motherboards one runs on let me see. So this is how it goes. Does it go in? Yep. So we have two motherboards. One is a Broadcom motherboard, and the other one it's an Intel motherboard. And the first thing that we need to do, we need to open two sessions to them. And that's basic PowerShell talking over WSMan opening two sessions. We have one to Broadcom motherboard, the other to Intel motherboard. Bingo, it works. And now, works because it's a video. Wait, it worked. I was typing. But because, let me stop for a second. There's an important point. Because these manufacturers of the boards implemented standard interface, which is defined by so-called profiles, smash and dash profiles, we can expect certain things from them. And we expect that they actually implement this class, which is SimChassis. And therefore, we can inquire what they are, and they will tell you, I'm an Intel and I'm a Lenovo, right? And then, there you go. So one is a HP, the other is a Lenovo, right? And then, because they implement the smash and dash profiles, we created a module, partial module, that abstracts the details of those profiles and creates a number of very basic commandlets that you can then talk to those devices, like, you know, the BMCs. And actually, it's available. You can download that. And if you look at the module in a second, I'll show you. There are all kinds of commandlets by which you can figure out what is the power state of your device, what is your hardware inventory. So here, I think we'll see what the hardware inventory is on those two devices first. But there is a set of commandlets through which you can now interact with the BMCs, which is motherboards, controllers on motherboards. So let's try this hardware inventory, and it will get hardware inventory from these two boards, and no surprise. One is slower than the other. Intel was slower. Get hardware inventory. There you go. It got inventory from both HP and the Lenovo. It was my laptop and another box. And then I can actually inquire the power state of these two devices. So one is on, and the other one is deeply sleeping. and then we can change the state of those, and we can turn one of those on. So let me stop that, because the main point of that particular demo is that we can now, from PowerShell, talk to any device that implements standard management protocol, right? Standard management interface. This is another demo that shows how we can talk from PowerShell to OMI. So OMI is running on Linux. So I'm getting the session to the Linux box. Let's figure out whether this is a Linux box. It is a Linux box. As you could see, it says Linux. So PowerShell talks to a VM running Linux, and OMI runs on it. And just for fun, we implemented two providers on it. One provider actually finds directories, and the other provider, one class implements a definition of a directory, and another class implements a definition of files. So I created a description of a directory, which you can see it's /opt. And then let me stop it quickly. So that got that directory. As you could see, I could get from PowerShell running on Windows a directory on Linux. And then the files that are in that directory are associated classes. So in a second, I'll get an associated classes. So fundamentally what has happened that I found directory and I said, find me all associated files. And you could see that that listed the files in the directory that actually contains OMI itself on that Linux box. And the third quick demo, so this was PowerShell right here talking to Linux. And the last one, I'd like to show how Linux can talk to Windows 2012. So I'm now in that Linux. I opened Chrome browser, and I'm now getting into the OData service on that box. And that service just implements basic classes. One of them is this net IP address. So I can now, from Linux, using the OData service, I can now enumerate net IP addresses. This is the definition. So that's a command that the OData service tells you everything it knows. This is this model that it runs with. So now I can do all kinds of interesting stuff. So I can enumerate those. So that says that there is actually a set of, I can enumerate all the net IP addresses. So I will enumerate them. It goes quickly, but I ask that to be actually enumerated and then shown in JSON. So here it's how the net IP addresses that I got through data look represented in JSON. And I can do all kinds of stuff. I can, for example, find out how many of them are there. So this is one address. And now I believe I'll just get the number of those. Yep. So I said, how many of them are there? And then you can play all kinds of games. Obviously, through the browser, the set of games is limited because you can only do gets. But if you write a Python client, then you can do whatever you want. The main point is now that we can talk from PowerShell to non-PowerShell, from PowerShell to OMI, and from anything to Windows through OData. The result is like this, of this. So that's 2 years of heavy work, heavy lifting. We said that multiple times that in the new server there is 2,400 different commandlets. Almost half of those commandlets, almost exactly half of those commandlets, are those commandlets that have been automatically generated from those CDXML files. PowerShell can access any device that speaks WSMan. If something talks WSMan back, PowerShell can talk to it. Any client implementing WSMN protocol can talk to Windows. That's the other. So in other words, Windows exposes WSMN protocol. All data can be used to manage anything, and OMI can run everywhere. That's sort of the basic premise of what we wanted to accomplish. And I squeezed you, right? Call to action. Buy servers that implement the standards. Buy storage that implements standards. If you're developing anything and exposing standard management interfaces, or management interfaces, expose standard management interfaces. If you believe that there are none, work with us, make them standard. Thank you.
That's great. Good afternoon. I'm Gene Chellis, Director of Program Management for the Windows Server Storage and Availability Group. We're going to talk a little bit about storage. We've seen the stack, started from the bottom. Storage is a domain of some application that you can use all this plumbing and the management stack for in order to be able to actually accomplish the objective that you need to get done. So we're going to talk about storage, and then I'll come back and show the SMIS layer, which is really in the management space, but it's how you use standard space management to enable management of storage on Windows now. So just a little context about storage and interoperability. So we think that for storage, getting back your data is the essence of what interoperability is all about. Customers seem to care about that as well. We have this long history of being involved with interoperability and storage. We recognize, and I think it's evolved over the years. So some of you have some other ideas of how we may have acted in the past. Some of our history is good. Some of it could be better. But I want to tell you a little bit about where we are currently and some of the engagement, both on the formal standards and on some of the de facto standards, particularly where we are defining some of these things. And it's similar to what you heard earlier. We're defining the way that interoperability works, but then we're going out and engaging and enabling the industry to be able to use those. So let's start with NFS. NFS is, as most of you know, the network file system. It's the remote file system access for Linux and Unix, developed originally by Sun. We've shipped an NFS server, a V3 server and client since 1999, so it's been a while. It's evolved in different ways that we got it out to the market, but we've had this there as a way to interact with Unix and Linux systems for quite some time. With Windows Server 2012, two things that are new. One is that we used the work that we did on SMB continuous availability, and we drove that into the NFS server. So the NFS V3 server now has continuous availability. It has transparent failover the same way that we build for SMB within the scope of what the NFS protocol can do. It's a great way, for instance, to deploy VMware running against Windows storage using NFS v3. We also built the brand new NFS v4.1 server included in Windows Server 2012, RFC compliant, and take a look at the performance if you care about that. We have an NFS client for Windows, and the way we've done that is working with the University of Michigan, where they've developed that, and it's being released under an open source license as a client for the Windows operating system. So just a little point about the interoperability and the way that we test this. This is a small list of the different NFS implementations that we've tested our NFS server against. iSCSI, if you don't use NFS block services, File services, perhaps you use block services, and iSCSI is another standard implementation of how you get access to data across a network. In this case, it's block access. We've shipped this for a number of years as well. The iSCSI initiator is in Windows client and server. The iSCSI target was in the past only in the Windows storage server SKU that was sold through OEMs. A year ago, we made that available as a free download to run on Windows Server 2008 R2, but in Windows Server 2012, it's in the box, it's part of the product. And again, we took the continuous availability concepts that if you heard the talk this morning, we define continuous availability in a way that, as this example shows, if you have a failure, we're going to make the failover of the server to the other storage node, and the client will automatically reconnect and will bring all of this data across with us. So that's now in the box as well as available for download. All right, so SMB interoperability. So why are we talking about this in a standards presentation, you might ask? Well, I wanted to make the point that even though SMB is not defined in a standard, we in fact did a whole lot of innovation in SMB 3.0 for this release, but we still believe in the principles that Jeffrey talked about, the principle of interoperability, the principle of making sure that we can work in a heterogeneous environment and that customers can get to their data. So whether you use a Windows file server to store your data on, or whether your storage vendor of choice is some other vendor, we want to make that available. So more than a year ago, we started engaging the industry. We published the formally open on the internet. We've published the specifications for the SMB3 protocol. We called it SMB2.2 at the time, back last September. And we've been actively working with a number of storage industry partners on this so that multiple vendors are implementing it. Two of them, EMC and NetApp, have announced that they will have support by the time of Windows Server 2012 general availability. There's a number of other vendors that are also working on that. So it's our protocol, but it's also being implemented and engaging in the industry. For instance, last fall we did a plug fest, and I just wanted to throw up a few of the companies that are involved in the SMB interoperability testing that we sponsor at the SNIA event in the fall. All right, SMIS interoperability. So we heard about the plumbing layers that Wojcik told you about how we manage various components in Windows. And in the past, the way we managed storage we had a separate proprietary model called VDS, Virtual Disk Service. And if you wanted to have storage as a storage vendor and have it be managed by Windows, we had one choice. We said, implement a VDS provider. If you did that, Windows could see it, we could manage it. That was all fine. Turned out that there was this developing standards about how you manage storage called the Storage Management Initiative Specification by the SNIA organization. And our storage partners started telling us, hey, we're implementing this standard already. Why don't you implement to that standard so that you can manage us and we don't have to write a separate provider? We said, okay. So about 2 years ago, we joined the SMIS technical working group. We have been participating in changes in the definition of it. One of the program managers at Microsoft is an active proponent and push on that. We've built the SMIS implementation, and we've built it into the Windows storage manager so that you can manage an SMIS-based storage, just like you can manage a VDS model. So this example is just how we do that in parallel. You can still write a VDS provider, or you can write an SMIS provider. So since I have about 3 minutes left, 4 minutes left, I'm going to run this demo really quickly. The point of the demo is just to show you an example of how we do this. This is Server Manager. We're going to go look at storage pools. In this pool, you can see a pool that, as you can see in the lower right, it's coming from a Clarion storage array. It has a bunch of characteristics that are not part of Windows storage, but we can expose that because the SMIS provider will bring up those properties and Storage Manager can get it. So we're going to go create a new virtual disk based on this pool. Click, give it a name. The storage pool is selected from the context that we took. And then storage layout. Here, I'm going to stop. Let me go back just slightly. The storage layout, you'll see it talks about the... didn't stop it again. Okay. See if I can get this to... Yes. So it's got RAID 5. RAID 5 is not something that we've implemented like that. So this is coming from the Clarion storage array up through SMIS to Storage Manager, but then we expose that to you so that... as an administrator, so that you can use those characteristics to choose as you set up the way to run this on your system. Same thing with the next slide, thin provisioning. And you can use thin provisioning to specify here a volume size that's larger than the actual free space that you have in the disk. That's provided by the Clarion array. You're familiar probably with thin provisioning. Now the wizard is just going to go create that virtual disk down through SMIS, tells the array what to do. It's going to go zoom from that into the new volume wizard, set up a volume, which will then make that virtual disk available to Windows with the typical drive letter or local volume. And then just to round out the story here, in the next few seconds, it's going to go run that wizard, show you then how that you can see that in Storage Manager as a disk, part of a pool. You can see the physical disks. You can see the volumes. All of them are up here as different views as you could pivot that around in Storage Manager. But the point of this demo is just the array is doing that, providing the capabilities. We're just piping those up through the management interfaces that we talked about, so to make that available to you in Windows and without the vendor having to write something different. So one more slide here on some additional information about availability, and I wanted to point you, as you're interested in that, there's a whole lot of information about our protocols, the openness approach, the interoperability bridges, ways that we try to endorse and engage the ecosystem in making sure that heterogeneous systems work for you and your organization. With that, I'm going to hand it back to Jeffrey.
Thank you, Gene. I really love that demonstration because it highlights our approach to standards. Now, some people hear standards and they think least common denominator, make everything look the same. No. That's not our model. Our model is we want to be able to interoperate with everything, but then also be able to take the unique characteristics of things and allow those to shine through so that you get the benefits of these things. Okay? So that's our approach. So the call to action is really quite simple. You know, look for standards when you buy stuff. It's that simple. You know, we're going to go tell people you should do this. We're going to tell our partners you should do this. I can guarantee you that you, as part of your purchasing decision, when you ask whether or not it supports it, is far more powerful than us telling them that. So you should do that. In particular, ask for the management standards. This is an area that you know, we're pushing hard on. And then you should provide feedback on the standards. Hey, we believe it's giving you everything that you need, but if that's not the case, let us know. We'll advocate for you. To to get those standards changed. And if you want to, participate in the standards itself. We have a lot of companies that participate in some of these standards and are just fantastic partners in moving the ball forward. So we've got a bunch of related content here. Take a look at that. And thank you very much for your time. Cheers.